It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Stephen Colbert joked a while back that a young adult novel is a regular novel that people actually read. The same could be said about a lot of children's literature. Kids are good readers, and there's a lot of great work out there aimed directly at them. Later this hour, I'll talk with two of the Iowa winners of the Letters About Literature program. They wrote letters about books that mean a lot to them. But first, Ernie Cox knows a lot about the best in new children's literature. He is a school librarian in the College Community District south of Cedar Rapids, and he's also the chair of the Newbery Selection Committee. The Newbery Award, of course, is the most prestigious award given in the world of children's literature in the United States. And Ernie is here with us right now. Hello, Ernie.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And first of all, this is a one-year appointment as chair of the Newbery Committee, and every year there's a whole new committee for this process?
Yeah, so that's part of the committee structure that I don't know a lot of people know about, is that it's a group of 15 librarians from across the country that we convene for a year's time and try to read as much of the publications and children's literature as possible in that year to make our decision.
So how did you get selected?
Well, I've been a member of the Association for Library Service to Children for a bunch of years, and I've served on some other awards that they administer, like the Cyber, which is a book award for informational books for kids. I served on their board of directors for a few years, and after I did that, I was asked by the president to chair the 2016 committee.
And what is the commitment like?
It's a large commitment for committee members. We had some funny stories from our committee members. They got great questions from people like, how much do you get paid to serve on this committee? The answer is nothing, but you do get a lot in return. You do devote a lot of your time, and I know all of our committee members, their families and loved ones took up a lot of slack for them, so they could read almost endlessly through the year of 2015 and try to read everything that we could.
So give me an idea. How much do you think you read?
I mean, on average, I was reading a book a day, and I think that's probably true of almost all of the committee. So it's several hours a day. I did get faster, which I thought after being a librarian for over a decade, I was reading as fast as I could. But I did increase my reading speed, and so we were trying to read about a book a day.
Wow.
If not more.
Now, all of that said, the book you picked probably didn't take you a lot of time to read. You kind of made a splash by picking a picture book this year. Tell me about the book that you picked.
Well, yeah. So it was Last Stop on Market Street. It is a picture book. I can't remember how many times I read it over the course of that year. But, you know, it spoke to us on so many different levels. And something that you and I were talking about a little bit before the show was just that the Newbery is really intended to recognize great writing for kids from birth to 14, which is a huge range when you look at the literature published for kids in that range. And, you know, the Newbery has trended in the past to be toward kind of a middle grade.
Right. I've done a little hanging around of Newbery honor shelf at the library, and they're almost all chapter books. And, I mean, upper elementary, maybe middle school chapter books.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I think that's been the norm. We found picture books this year that we thought the writing for a picture book format was just superb. And I don't know what other committees thought in the years past. Maybe they depended on the Caldecott, which is recognizing illustrations.
But not the writing.
Right. The writing is usually pretty good, but the illustrations are what carried it through. And in this book, we just found so many of the elements of that you depend on in a great picture book, which is usually intended to be read by a more advanced reader to a younger audience. And when you read this book aloud, you can hear the great qualities of picture book writing. Maybe later I could read
Well, actually, why don't you do it right now?
Let me read the opening pages of Last Stop on Market Street, right until they get on the bus for the heart of the journey here. CJ pushed through the church doors, skipped down the steps. The outside air smelled like freedom, but it also smelled like rain, which freckled CJ's shirt and dripped down his nose. He ducked under his Nana's umbrella, saying, "How come we gotta wait for the bus and all this wet?" "Trees get thirsty too," his Nana told him. "Don't you see that big one drinking through a straw?" CJ looked for a long time, but never saw a straw. She's referring to a tree trunk there. From the bus stop, he watched water pool on flower petals. Watched rain patter against the windshield of a nearby car. His friend Colby climbed in, gave CJ a wave, and drove off with his dad. Nana, how come we don't got a car? Boy, what do you need a car for? We got a bus that breathes fire, and old Mr. Dennis, who always has a trick for you. The bus creaked to a stop in front of them. It sighed and sagged, and the door swung open. And then they board the bus for the rest of their journey and their final destination. But just in those few pages, you can hear the alliteration. It sighed and sagged, and the door swung open. Reading that on the page is one thing, but when you're saying it out loud, it really captures your ear and draws you to the language. One thing that the Newbery criteria says is that we can only consider pictures if they detract from the text. And what we found is the pictures worked great with the text because Nana talks about the bus breathing fire. And when you look at that spread, you see that the city bus has a dragon on the side with fire coming out of its mouth. So in that case, the picture works so great with the language that Nana's using. And just De La Pena's use of language to describe what's happening, like the rain freckling CJ's shirt. What a great description, and it's a language that kids will understand. They've seen freckles, and now they're hearing it used in this really different way. And the whole book is full of CJ's questions, many of them that kids will have.
Going to say one of my favorite things when I read a picture book with a child is that they'll ask. They always want to follow up and know more, and you can ask them questions, and they can ask you questions. And I thought of five questions I could ask just from those first pages.
When I read this with young kids, there were so many questions that they had. Later on the bus, they meet a blind person. And many of these kids that I read to said they had never met or seen anyone who was visually impaired. What a great conversation we had about just that one character in this entire book.
So when it was announced, what kind of a reaction did you get from people? Because, a lot of us are expecting chapter books.
Right, right. I think some people were really happy that finally, after, this award's been going on since 1922, there's been some picture book formats, but with poetry often. So this was really the first picture book text. And a lot of people were really excited to see that writing embraced as writing that can be great. Some people had a lot of questions, so we kind of sent them back to the criteria that pretty plainly spells out that this is possible. If anything, I think it's been a great opportunity to talk more about what great picture book text can sound like and what it can do for kids, and that's been really exciting for me.
Now, a lot of people really depend on Newbery Awards as they guide their kids. Librarians depend on them. Parents depend on them as they guide children towards certain books. What do you think it means? I mean, obviously you sell a lot of books, which is really exciting in a very tough world of publishing. What does it mean for a book to get this honor?
You know, I mean, that's where I kind of depend on the people who have won it to tell me what it means. And many of them, it does mean that they know that some of their work will be in print forever. So you can still get many of the books from even the 20s and 30s are still actively in print. And there is a monetary gain to that, but also just the idea that your book will be available for generations to come. I think it allows you some freedom to go and create new stuff that you might not have had the opportunity to do before. You and I talked a little bit before about just getting a book published and what it takes to get a publisher on board. And when you have that Newbery honor or that Newbery medal, it really means you're going to be able to be creative in directions that you might not have before. And I'll just give you some examples. Kwame Alexander won the Newbery last year before last with Crossover. And now he's writing some books that I don't know. I'm not sure he would have had the opportunity to do it. He's done a picture book now, and he has a new book called Booked that's coming out about a kid playing soccer. And you can just tell he's having great fun with language and with structure and that comes from having the prestige of the Newbery with you.
Now, some people classics, of course, stick around forever. And some people will speak kind of disparagingly about modern books, thinking that the classics are the best. From my perspective, it feels like maybe we're kind of living through a golden age in children's literature right now. I'd love to hear your perspective on that. You just spent a year immersed in everything new.
Yeah. I do think we're in a really special time. I mean, we, you know, a quarter of our population are kids under 18. So there's a huge potential readership there. And I think publishers are realizing if they bring in a wide array of illustrators and authors and start telling a lot of new stories or stories we haven't heard enough of, that there's a readership for that. I've noticed like the New York Times Book Review now has used to their book review coverage of kids' books was really sparse. And now they're regularly reviewing books because there is so much exciting stuff happening. I think there's a lot more that can be done, but I think publishers really are working to bring in new voices of all kinds, and that resonates because we're a country of all kinds of stories, and a lot of them haven't been told or haven't been told in a way that maybe got us the whole truth.
One of my favorite children's authors, Daniel Pinkwater, once told me that he loved to write for kids because he felt like kids were better readers than adults. He says grown-ups read to fall asleep. Kids read to explore new worlds and find out more. So, I mean, in talking with different authors, it's got to feel like a real opportunity to connect with kids.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the things that authors tell me about awards like the Newbery is that it gives them the confirmation that it's okay to write really complex, interesting, sophisticated books. The kids are there for those books. Kate DiCamillo is a great example of this. The language in her books, the vocabulary, she doesn't shy away from really writing big stories because she knows there's a child audience for them that will respond to that.
Well, and I do want to talk in just a few minutes about one of the other winners of a couple years ago, Catherine Applegate, who won for her book, The One and Only Ivan. As we dive into a conversation about maybe things that we don't see very much in children's books, and in the picture book that you picked, we see a much more diverse picture of characters than we
Absolutely.
Do in a lot of picture books. Was that part of your message? Did you want to reward that?
Well, you know, again, we really, the pictures, we only looked at them in terms of were they making the story better. I think the fact that CJ and his Nana are riding a bus opens up a scene that many of us know and many people know. And that was important to us.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Ernie Cox, who's a school librarian in the College Community School District south of Cedar Rapids. He is also chair this year of the Newbery Selection Committee. We're going to talk more about children's literature. And then later in the hour, the nationwide contest Letters About Literature. I'll talk with two of the Iowa winners of that contest. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about children's literature. And coming up later, we'll talk about the Letters About Literature contest, which involves young people writing a letter to the author, living or dead, of a book that means a lot to them. We'll talk with two of the Iowa winners and hear their letters. Right now, I'm talking with Ernie Cox. He is a school librarian in the College Community District, which is south of Cedar Rapids. He's also chair of the Newbery Selection Committee. And Ernie, before the break, we were talking generally about, since you've been immersed in new children's literature, some of the great stuff that's out there. But there are also, over the past years, there have been people saying, hey, we need to make sure that our children's literature reflects our society a little more fully. And the book that you chose, again, it shows some diversity. Yeah. And that has been lacking in children's literature. Are you seeing a shift in that?
I think I'm seeing some shifting, or at least we're seeing an intent to shift. I think there's, you know, I know one of the things we talked about before the show was a recent survey of publishing houses looking at the diversity of publishing staff. And what that revealed, it's largely a white group of people selecting what will get published. And, you know, I think publishers are looking at that and thinking, how has this determined what we have done and maybe what we haven't done? So I think there is really an intent on publishers' part to be more conscious of what are we doing with the power we have to publish books. Are we getting more stories, more authors out there? But yeah, I think there's definitely new stuff coming that we haven't seen before. One place that I was looking at just before the show was the We Need Diverse Books website. And if listeners haven't gone to that, it's a great resource with many book lists. And they have an entire page of their site devoted to summer reading. And it has a little pairing of if you liked this book, you might like this book. And many of those give a diverse array of stories and characters. And more than the just cultural and ethnic, we're talking about economic diversity, kids that are adopted, kids being raised by grandparents, the whole array of stories out there. That's a great source to see some new books coming out or recent books that have come out.
Well, and I mentioned Catherine Applegate earlier, who is a Newbery winner herself. Her most recent novel that came out is called Crenshaw. And that seems like a great example of this sort of economic diversity, because the family is homeless at a time. They actually have lived in their car for a while. They may be facing homelessness again. And she interviewed kids that had lived in a homeless shelter to try to get their perspective in writing the book. And when I read about that, I thought, I don't know that that's going to be that enjoyable to read. But then the novel is just wonderful. It's heartwarming. Right. It's funny. It's brilliant. So when we talk about needing diversity or needing to address these other topics, do you think sometimes people think, no, we don't. These are supposed to be fun books.
Right. oh, sure. Yeah. And, you know, and I think one of the things that anchors librarians in our work when we talk about this is work like Rudine Sims Bishop. She wrote a great piece several years ago about children's literature being it offers windows into other worlds and also a mirror on your own world. And a book like Crenshaw does that. You know, we have our child poverty rate in Iowa is about 15%. In some counties, it's as high as 30. So we have kids in Iowa that live in these situations that are portrayed in Crenshaw. But we also have a lot of kids that go to school with those kids. And a book provides both of those kids an opportunity to see themselves, but also to see into something that they may not have understood as well before they read it.
When I read that book with both of my kids, they're 8 and 10 now, and they both loved it, and it was a great read-aloud book. But something that I noticed as we were reading it was I felt like the author was also being purposeful about not making the ethnic makeup of the book known, not telling you the race of any of the characters in the book, especially the main characters, and the illustrations also don't reveal that. And I thought that was a very interesting move.
Yeah, I assume it's intentional. I mean, you know, we can talk about what would her purpose be in that. You know, when we look at graphic novels, sometimes the characters, there's parts of the book that the illustrations or the character isn't clearly drawn out. And there's a reason that that happens. So the reader sometimes can put onto that character what they want to see. So maybe that's what she was up to. I'm not sure.
Now, speaking of graphic novels, a graphic novel was one of the runners-up for this year's Newbery Medal. So were you trying to look for different entries into this category?
No, we didn't set out to. I didn't tell my committee we must pick a graphic novel in here somewhere. That was not our intent. But you know, the year before was the first time an honor book had been selected that was a graphic novel, El Defo, by C.C. Bell, and I think that shows that one committee can really give the next year an opportunity to look more closely at literature that maybe we weren't reading closely. So we read a bunch of graphic novels, and Roller Girl is just a fantastic story of adolescence. You know, it's really about a girl getting ready. It's the summer before junior high, which is kind of terrifying for everyone. She's full of questions, anxiety, friendships kind of falling apart, and she finds roller derby as an outlet to find a new group of friends and a new level of confidence that you just know is going to take her into junior high. So the characterization in that book is what spoke to us really deeply.
Now, I remember a few years ago when the invention of Hugo Cabret was selected. And of course, this is, if you haven't looked at this book, it's a really unusual book because it is a novel, but it's also a graphic novel, although not at all like any graphic novel that anybody had seen before. I mean, it's full of pictures, but not in that kind of panel setup that we think about. And I remember listening to sound from the Newbery announcement, and the audience just went crazy because librarians loved this book, but they didn't think that it would actually get picked by the committee. Do you think that was the beginning of a sea change?
Well, I think that was a significant year, and, you know, I think last year there was a lot of discussion about the need for an award to just recognize graphic novels, or at least one that the American Library Association would host. I'm always quick to tell people the Eisners have been recognizing graphic novels for a bunch of years. But, you know, there's a lot of the right books aren't going to get recognized. And, you know, what committees have shown over the last few years is if you look at the terms, you realize there's some really specific things in there, but there's also a lot of latitude for committees to make decisions that speak to the evolving nature of children's literature, because there's a lot of creativity and people keep pushing boundaries and mixing genres, and these awards can take that into account.
I'm talking with Ernie Cox. He is the chair of the Newbery Selection Committee this year. He's also a school librarian in the College Community District. And this is the time of year when you start to see a lot of lists come out. Yeah. A lot of school districts are releasing their lists and saying, hey, here's some great summer reading opportunities. Of course, libraries all over the place are gearing up for their summer reading programs. And parents everywhere are kind of fretting because they think, how can I keep my kids reading through the summer? And I mean, as a school librarian, I'm sure you have seen firsthand the step backward that we take when we don't read during the summer. How significant is that if your kid just kind of stops reading for a few months?
It's significant. We call it the summer slide or summer reading gap. But it really, over the course of a few years, it can equal a year of reading achievement. So by the time a kid reaches middle school, if they haven't been reading consistently through those summers of elementary, the difference is a couple grade levels of ability, which really has a huge impact, not just academically, but emotionally. And kind of me as an adolescent, now I'm having all of these reading struggles. So it's very real. So how do you get them to read, right?
Yeah, how did you know? That was my next question. It's almost like you've been asked before.
I have. When I first started doing this a bunch of years ago, I thought just making a list and distributing it was enough. And now I'm not so sure. I mean, there's a lot of great lists out there. I do think it's really important that if you're going to put those lists in front of your kids, that you give them agency. So one thing we know in my district, we've been working really hard on summer reading. And one thing we found is the power of choice to motivate is huge. So don't give the list and say, read every book on this list. There has to be choice. The other thing we know when we talk to kids that read a lot are that they see other people reading around them, or there's kind of an environment where reading is a thing that happens. And I think that's where parents do have a big role to play. I think reading aloud to your kids is a great way to foster time reading over the summer. And that doesn't have to stop when they can read on their own. I think a lot of people know and have discovered that if you read to your middle grade kid or even your high school kid, reading a book aloud can have a really special time together, and it can just keep that reading happening.
Now, you talk about giving kids agency. I know that you are a dad.
Yeah.
And your kids are pretty close in age to my kids. And one thing that I've noticed with my daughter, who is a reader and loves to read, somehow subliminally, if I let her know how important a book is to me, that book loses all interest to her. So as a parent, you want to give kids agency, but do you have any advice for us on how to introduce books and actually stoke the interest instead of kill it?
Yeah. I have chaired the Newbery, and I can still recommend books to my 11-year-old that she will refuse to look at. So that's a very real thing. I just leave them laying around her room sometimes, and then she'll pick them up and wonder why they were there. I think this is where, just to really promote public libraries and the great work that public libraries do, the role of a public librarian with your child can be really crucial, because they become a trusted adult outside of the parent. And, parent-child relationships could be complicated. But they'll often trust the opinion of a trusted adult, a librarian, a teacher, and also giving them an opportunity to interact with other kids. Because one thing I know when I talk to students, they most often have a book that a peer has recommended to them. So just facilitating those conversations. And this could be simple. I mean, it could be a little get together on the back porch of your street. It could be a public library event. There's a whole lot of ways to get kids interacting around books and really capture that social experience.
What about book clubs for kids?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We host a couple at my school. We do a mock Newbery Club. We also have a Guys Read Club.
A mock Newbery Club.
Mock
Newbery.
What does that mean? So we attempt to decide what the Newbery Committee will decide.
Oh,
so we try
wow.
to go through a similar process and use the criteria. And then we have a Guys Read Book Club, which some days you don't really see books around at all, but there's conversation about books and there's interaction with each other around ideas that come from literature and comic books and all kinds of sources, including just pop culture stuff. I think there's always the tension for parents between wanting to give kids quality and what they consider to be quality literature and then the things that are really popular. And, you know, I would argue you can have both, but often you're going to need to use the popular stuff. So, you know, most TV shows that kids see on Nickelodeon or whichever channel they're watching, there's probably some kind of print outgrowth from that might be the thing that'll get your kid looking at books over the summer. So be open to
don't be a snob.
Not right away, at least. Be open to what it's going to take to get that foot in the door.
Now, okay, a lot of book summer book programs will say you need to read a half an hour a day.
Right.
You know, there's an incentive program, and a lot of parents will try to do the same thing. How do you know if your child is getting something out of that time, if you're trying to enforce, you know, read for a half an hour,
sure.
How do you know they're actually comprehending and getting anything out of the experience?
Yeah. I mean, and this is where the parent does have a lot to do with this, is just having conversations about what you're reading. What have you liked about the book? Have you liked the character? Have you liked where the setting is? And just asking them some questions about what they're enjoying as a way to figure out, are they there yet? Is this the book they need to be in? I mean, one thing we do know is if they're not reading books over the summer that they can really read at a high degree of accuracy, and this isn't to say that kids shouldn't pick up a book that's hard for them, because that we know that that's part of the growth dynamic. But a lot of the books, they really do need to understand them. If there's a lot of vocabulary they're not picking up, there's whole lines of things that right. are getting missed.
I think that can be really challenging for younger siblings, because they just want to read what their big brother or sister
Absolutely.
Is reading.
Yeah. And that's where its big sister could read to a little sister for a little bit. Maybe mom could get a break.
So one of the things that I love about summer reading programs is because it seems like very appropriate bribery. Is it okay to bribe your kids into reading?
Well, Charity, this is a huge discussion in the field of librarianship. Is like, do we give the little prizes out and do drawings? And, it varies from one public library to the next. I think a lot of us that read into adulthood and read by choice, we know that the real reward comes from a lot of internal things. I don't know if we can expect a first grader to get all of that internal good stuff right away. And one thing I've seen happen in a lot of public libraries, many of my colleagues in the Chicago public library system have really made a shift to summer learning. So along with the reading focus, there's all kinds of STEM, science, technology, engineering, math activities that kids are engaging in. And the kids themselves can see, what have I gained over the summer in terms of my knowledge and my experience, and kind of shifting from the trinket to, oh, this is what I know now that I didn't know before. So I think there's some ways you can move beyond blatant bribery, maybe.
One of the things that I try to do with my older child, just because I want to kind of have a foot in the world that she's exploring, is instead of just trying to lead her, I also follow her. So if mm-hmm. she's into a series of books, I'll pick it up and I'll read a book or two. Is that something you think is a good idea for parents, so that, you know, we can talk knowledgeably about the world of Percy Jackson or whatever it may be?
Absolutely. You know, I think if we're serious about giving kids choices, and that we're really serious about them owning their reading lives, which is what we want. We want them to become independent readers. We need to follow their lead some. And that will lead down some aisles at the library that you may not be excited about. I had a summer of rainbow fairies with my daughter a few years ago, and there are shelves and shelves. Daisy Meadows is prolific. And it wasn't a part of my...
And she's got a formula.
She's got a formula, which served a purpose for that,
right.
that kid at that time. And that was important for me, even though professionally I understood what a formulaic story with a series could do for a reader. It was really cool to see that happen with my own kid. And after about 10 of them, I let her just take over on her own, and we didn't read those together anymore because I couldn't do it. But where you started out, though, is really, I think we do have to trust their decisions. And I'm living that now in middle school with my oldest. She's picking up stuff I didn't really think I would be too interested in, but she is. So giving them the lead really could go a long way.
Are there books on the horizon that you are particularly excited about?
I knew you were going to ask me this, and I always try to have a list in my head. There are a bunch of books. Thinking to pop culture, talking about pop culture, Lisa Yee has a new book coming out called Wonder Woman Superhero High, I think is the whole title. And it is Wonder Woman the early years, so when she left the island and went to high school. And there's more about that I can talk about
all
if
right,
you want.
But yeah. We're out of time. But Ernie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ernie Cox is the chair of the Newberry Selection Committee for this past year, and he is a school librarian in the College Community District, which is south of Cedar Rapids. Coming up in just a moment, the Letters About Literature program. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Letters About Literature is a reading and writing contest for students in grades 4th through 12th. Students read a book, a poem, or a speech, and they write to the author about what the book means to them. The letters are then submitted and judged on the state level, and winners can even go on to the national contest. Josie Boyle is the first place winner in Iowa for grades 4 through 6 this year. She's a 5th grader at Drexler Middle School in Farley, and she wrote her letter to J.K. Rowling.
Dear J.K. Rowling, I read the entire Harry Potter series during the summer of 2013, the same time that I watched my beloved grandfather lose his life after a 10-month-long battle with esophageal cancer. It ripped me to pieces seeing my grandma, parents, aunts, uncles, and cousins grieve so intensely over his death. I remember seeing them try to hold back their tears for my brothers and me, although the red splashy spots on their faces were hard to ignore. I remember watching my grandpa lay in a bed of flowers, motionless, in an endless sleep. I remember kneeling in front of his coffin, head bent. I remember. It seems like just yesterday that I read your books. The blow of Grandpa's death was passing, but the grief was still fresh in my heart. My family had not yet moved on, and I was still trapped in the cage of sorrow. As I opened your first book in the series, I felt an instant connection between Harry and myself. His parents were killed by the Dark Wizard Voldemort when he was just 1 year old. He was devastated by his parents' death. It seemed that the grief both Harry and I felt over the loss of people we love united us. Hermione Granger, one of Harry's best friends, once said, "Fear of the name only increases fear of the thing itself." She, of course, was referring to Voldemort, as many people were too terrified to speak his name out of fear of his wickedness. However, when I think about this statement and relate it to my life, that thing Hermione referred to is cancer. I admit it. Cancer scares me. As the word forms on my lips, a rush of terror always runs up my spine. Not just my grandfather, but many people I know and love are living with or have been claimed by cancer. Just as every character in the series feared Voldemort, I fear cancer. I will never forget the many hours I spent snug in my bed reading, reading, and reading your books. I was able to escape the grief of the world and dive into one of my own creation, my imagination. Your books were the building blocks of my castle, a castle in my head that no one could take away or take down. They opened my mind to new, positive thoughts. I found a key to open the cage of heartache I was trapped inside of. Your books also gave me hope, hope that my grandpa wasn't truly gone. I know he is in our hearts and lives there every day. Now, when my family sees an especially bright and beautiful sunset, we all hurry to the window to admire its color. Grandpa painted that, we say. Now, I remember my grandpa's love for farming. I remember countless tractor rides with him by my side. I remember a soft green chair he would sit in after a long day's work. I remember climbing into it with him and feeling safe inside his arms. And I remember the books that helped me through this time. I'll always remember your J.K. Rowling. With love and admiration, Josie Boyle.
Josie, thank you so much for sharing your letter with us. When your teacher invited you to write a letter to an author, did you know right away who you wanted to write to?
Not exactly. I remember thinking about it for a couple days and looking at the authors and their backgrounds, and then I finally thought that, yeah, I should definitely do J.K. Rowling.
And when you were reading the books, did you draw that connection in your mind between cancer and Lord Voldemort, or was that something that came in the writing of the letter for you?
I think it was more in the letter, because I was just thinking deeply about the books that I wrote, and I just kind of clicked, and I guess it was a little bit while I was reading, too.
Well,
I guess in both.
Yeah, I'm curious. I mean, when you were writing the letter and you sort of had that epiphany and that came to you, did that help you through your process of grief?
I guess it did a little bit, because it just kind of made me think of the happy times we had, too, and not necessarily the bad things.
Now, I know you submitted the letter to the contest. Did you also send it to J.K. Rowling?
No, I didn't.
Oh, you should. You absolutely should. All right, there's my advice for the day. Now, after being a part of this, and of course also being the first place winner in Iowa for the contest, which is such a wonderful honor.
Thanks.
Does this change how you read books after the fact?
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, because now what I do is I think about it, like after I'm done reading, I'll stop and think about it again and think, hey, maybe I could do a contest on this too, or think about how it connects to my life.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, definitely.
So what have you been reading lately?
Lately, I have been reading the Maze Runner series.
I've heard very good things about that. It's on my list. Well, what does it mean to you to be the first place winner in Iowa?
Oh, it's more than I ever thought, because I almost didn't enter in the first place thinking it's no use. There are so many entries. And then, well, here I am. It just means so much, because I would like to have a career in writing when I get older. So this kind of boosts my confidence.
Absolutely. Well, Josie, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Josie Boyle is a sixth grader at Drexler Middle School in Farley, Iowa. She is the level one winner in Iowa this year, and her letter received national consideration. Hannah Huang is the level two winner. She is an eighth grader in Ames, Iowa, and this is her letter.
Dear Caitlin Alafranca and Martin Gonda, the chaos theory talks about how small fluctuations in a complicated interconnected system, like weather, can end up causing startling consequences. It's often illustrated by the butterfly effect, how something as insignificant as a butterfly fluttering its wings might eventually cause a hurricane in a different part of the world. I'm no heroic butterfly. I'm a very normal girl. I go to school, do my homework, socialize with friends, and read a lot. One of the books I happened to read was your collaborative memoir, I Will Always Write Back, the story of two pen pals, one in a suburban Pennsylvania town, the other in the slums of Zimbabwe. I Will Always Write Back demonstrates the chaos theory perfectly, how small actions and choices can lead to astonishing results. Caitlin, your chapters were like reading a page out of my own life story. Just like what I am right now, you began as an ordinary American girl. At 12 years old, when you chose to have a pen pal from Zimbabwe, you said, "I didn't know it then. How could I have? But that moment would change my life." From a simple class assignment came a friendship that bridged an ocean and changed both of your lives. But what would have happened if you hadn't chosen Zimbabwe? What if Martin hadn't been the top student in his class, therefore earning the honor of being your pen pal? You wouldn't have learned about what life was like outside of a first world country. A typical 12-year-old American girl, far more interested in what I should wear to school than what I might learn there, is how you described yourself before your friendship with Martin. And Martin, instead of being able to attend an American university, would probably still be mired in Zimbabwe. Small choices lead to unimaginable consequences that one couldn't have dreamed of at the time of the decision. And that was when I had my epiphany. I used to think that my daily actions and choices had no real effect on the world at large. I mean, what could a young girl possibly do to change the world? But after reading this book, I realize that I am still able to have an impact on the small part of the world that I interact with. With this in mind, I started to volunteer my time with the preschoolers at church and my local food pantry, teaching children a new word, showing them how to use scissors, giving out food that would have otherwise gone to waste, seeing the smiles break out when I said, "Take as many tomatoes as you want." These are small things, but I hope that they've affected at least a few people's lives. Martin, you changed Caitlin's life too. It might seem like Caitlin was doing all the giving and you were doing all the taking, but you gave Caitlin something valuable too. Through your letters, you opened her eyes and mine as well by showing what life is like in countries that are not as lucky as America. Your family's only furniture was a single mattress, and your house was one room shared with another family. I couldn't even imagine living in such cramped quarters, and I used to think that my own personal bedroom, equipped with a desk, bed, and a closet filled with clothes, was sparse and small. As I continued to read, each chapter of yours increased my awareness of how naive I was. For example, I expected 3 fresh meals served up to me every day. If my mother was out and I had to make my own dinner, I would gripe about it incessantly, even with a refrigerator fully stocked and at my disposal. When I read about your family struggling even to buy satza, the cornmeal mush that was your daily subsistence, I felt ashamed of myself. And while I had 3 pairs of boots and a different pair of sneakers allotted for running, tennis, PE, and wearing to school, I was concerned with their color, style, and brand. I realized how superficial things they were to be concerned with when I found out that you didn't even own a single pair of shoes. There are things in life that seem so trivial that it's easy to forget how blessed and lucky I am to have them. I used to think of good food, a warm bed, and a roof over my head as some sort of inalienable right. I've since realized how mistaken I was in this notion after reading about what your life was like in Zimbabwe. It makes me all the more grateful for what I have. And when I say that I'm thankful for something at Thanksgiving, or even on a regular day, I really truly mean it now. And finally, I will always write back taught me how to be a better friend. Both of you went above and beyond the call of duty to sustain your friendship. Caitlin, you selflessly sent your babysitting money to Martin so he could stay in school. And Martin, you are determined to continue writing to Caitlin after your school stopped financing the cost of your correspondence, even carrying luggage for travelers just to scrape together the money needed to buy the stamps to put on the envelope. You both showed me that it is worth every little bit of effort expended to keep a friendship going. Now, I strive to emulate that type of admirable loyalty in my friendships as well. Over winter break, I emailed friends that I hadn't communicated with in years, discovering in the process that we still remember the same treasured memories and inside jokes. And I really try my best now to look beyond the surface of an individual. The old me used to write people off if they weren't made of the same mold I was, but now I have become friends with individuals of different ages, genders, and personalities. Your book showed me that inside every person, no matter how different compared to me, is the potential for a life-altering friendship. Caitlin and Martin, you have taught me to open my eyes to the world around me and ultimately become a better person. Your unlikely friendship showed me how 2 people with very different nationalities, beliefs, cultures, and aspirations can change each other's lives. The world suddenly becomes a more vivid place when we recognize contrasts and embrace them. That is, after all, what makes color TV so much better than black and white. Both of you have helped me rethink the place I hold in this world and what results from the smallest of actions. I have much to thank you for. I dare say your friendship, a single butterfly flapping in the air, has caused a small tempest elsewhere in the hearts and minds of your readers. With gratitude, Hannah Huang.
That's Hannah Huang reading from her letter about literature. She was the Iowa winner of the Level 2 category, and her letter was considered nationally, just a handful of letters considered for the national award. And Hannah, you were reading about the book, I Will Always Write Back. Has this process, writing these letters, has it changed how you read?
Yeah, definitely, because now when I read, I find myself having conversations with the author in my head because I did that with the letter, and now I just do it automatically when I'm reading other books as well.
Interesting. So do you think that that kind of enhances the experience of the book?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Well, Hannah, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, yes, it was a pleasure.
That's Hannah Huang of Ames Middle School. She was the Level 2 winner in Iowa this year. And with me now is Helen Dagley. She's coordinator for the Iowa Center of the Book, which oversees the contest in Iowa. Hello, Helen.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. We only have a couple of minutes because we spend so much time listening to those wonderful letters. But this was your first year actually digging in and judging the letters, right?
Yes, actually, I came on board at the end of October when my predecessor retired. And there's a number of programs that we administer to for the Center for the Book. But this is the most, so far, it has been extremely rewarding for me and labor-intensive, time-intensive as well, because it represents a lot of letters and absolute wonderful intent on all of them. We're just very, very pleased to have this kind of outcome every year from Iowa, which is relatively small in the scheme of things.
Right. About how many letters are submitted in Iowa?
This year we had almost 1,900.
Wow.
And it has remained constant, I guess, every year since we became part of the program.
So I'm curious, since this was your first year reading many, many, many of these letters, what was your reaction? How did you feel reading them?
Oh, they're life-affirming, I would say, is a big thing. I mean, there's so much negativity in the world at large, always, but particularly it seems like right now that this is almost like an antidote. When you read these, it brings home, you know, in all of us, you know, our basic human seeing of the world without agendas or whatever. It brings in a really affirming way.
So it's not an overstatement to say it really affirms your faith in humanity to read these letters by kids.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
And apparently, talking to both Hannah and Josie, it's a transformative experience for the kids who write the letters, too. How do you feel about that?
Yes, yes. Well, because part of the intent of the program is to have them bring it to themselves, to incidents in their own life or how they feel about a certain circumstance that's happening to them, that, you know, connects those things and brings out an outpouring, if you will, of not only creativity, but really, really deep seeing of life and bringing it back to their own situation as well.
And also makes them more thoughtful readers for the future.
Yes, yes. I don't think this is a one-time deal for any of them. I think it really is transformative. You know, how they see this is how they'll see things in the future when they read, and it will come back to them in their daily lives in some way. It connects that way as well.
Well, Helen, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Helen Dagley is coordinator for the Iowa Center of the Book. They oversee the Letters About Literature contest in Iowa, which, of course, is a nationwide contest where young people write a letter to the author of a book that means a lot to them. We've been talking about children's literature all this hour. Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Catherine Perkins, Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our intern is Lauren Knutson. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.